The appeals court is blocking one of outgoing Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's pet projects, the sale of 24 state-owned buildings. A three-judge panel has put a stay on the plan until it hears arguments next month. Three former members of the State Building Authority have sued to stop the sales as an unlawful gift of public funds. The plaintiffs also claim the plan illegally bypasses the California State Judicial Council. AT&T is expanding Wi-Fi access for its New York subscribers and introducing it in San Francisco. The company's trying to provide more data capacity in the two cities because use of Apple's iPhone and other wireless devices is very heavy in both places. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition. On the web at MetLife.org.
Hi, I'm Jim Meadows.
I'm Tom Rogers.
I'm Sean Powers.
And I'm Celeste Quinn. You listen to us on WILL Radio and TV, and now we want to listen to you. Every month, we're out in the community having conversations about your hopes and challenges. What we hear impacts the programs we produce. If you'd like to have a community conversation in your town, give us a call at 217-333-7300 or email willconnect@illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Freestar Bank, Champaign, Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning, Urbana, Prairie Ridge Farms Incorporated, Allerton, and Roland Realty, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. On a winter night in 1773, a group of men boarded three ships in Boston Harbor and dumped more than 46 tons of tea into the water. This is the event that came to be known as the Boston Tea Party, and it helped set the stage for the American Revolution. Our guest for the show, Benjamin Karp, he's an historian. He says that this event has always given off mixed signals. It has long been embraced as an important act of nonviolent political action, although many authorities today would probably consider it an act of terrorism. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the Tea Party, what it meant then and what it means now, as we talk with Benjamin Karp about his book, Defiance of the Patriots, The Boston Tea Party and the Making of America. It's published by the Yale University Press. Has come out recently. Our guest Benjamin Karp is Associate Professor of History at Tufts University, where he teaches the history of early America, and the Tea Party is something that has a particular interest of his. And Professor Karp, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us today. I expect that when you set out to work on this book, you had not anticipated that we would have had this movement in American politics that emerged so quickly and became so important in the last elections, calling itself a Tea Party.
No. When I first started this, it wasn't even a gleam in Rick Santelli's eye. Although the Tea Party has been around a long time as a reference point for Americans of all political stripes.
See, I think that is a point, obviously, you make, and a very important point, is that when we can talk, and we will talk about the actual event and what happened, but in the years ever since, people with various kinds of political causes and various kinds of political postures have identified with the Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, just I suppose to start, we can talk about the event itself. And I guess you have to start with tea and the fact that Americans, like the British, really liked drinking tea. And if you were going to buy tea legally, there was really only one place to go, and that was the British East India Company.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the British and their colonists in America and all over the world are crazy about tea. It's become this important middle-class ritual to drink tea, to have the finest ceramics that you can afford and the finest silver teapot that you can afford. They're just crazy about it. It's a big business, and the only game in town for the British to import it into Great Britain is the East India Company and their ships to China. Now, smuggling is also a big business, and so various continental European companies also go to China, bring back tea, and then sell a lot of that tea to Britain and America. But yeah, tea is a big thing.
Mm-hmm. So people had these two. Essentially, here in the United States, they had two choices. They could buy legal tea, and that would be British tea, but they could also buy illegal tea that was smuggled, and that seemed to be mostly something that the Dutch were involved in.
Yeah, the Dutch and parts of what's now Germany and the Scandinavia were all big into smuggling. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem comes I believe in 1767. When Britain puts a tax on the tea that were imported, that was imported into the colonies, I expect that probably a lot of people here, particularly people in Boston, thought, well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It just makes it more expensive, and all that's the only party here clearly that's going to benefit are the smugglers.
Yeah, that was what a lot of Boston tea merchants were worried about in 1767. I mean, on the other hand, it's not a huge tax; it's 3 pennies for a pound of tea. But you're right. I mean, the idea of driving up the price of legal tea even further seemed like it was going to help the smugglers out.
Mm. So this, and I guess also at the time in the Americas, there were some people, apparently people in the South. They thought the British tea was good enough, so, well, they were just willing to pay whatever was asked.
Sure, it was the easiest and most legal way to get tea, and so there were plenty of people who didn't have a problem with it. But as the Sons of Liberty get angrier and angrier at Parliament, the idea of not drinking legally imported tea becomes an important political statement.
Mm. And these feelings about this were particularly strong in New York and in Philadelphia, where pretty much everybody got together behind this boycott of British tea.
Yeah, by 1770, you can see on the customs records the amount of legal tea that was being imported into the Middle Colonies falls literally to zero in some places in the Middle Colonies. But it's not as if people weren't still drinking tea. It was just that they were drinking the illegal tea that they were getting from the Dutch and other parts of Central Europe.
Yeah. What's sort of interesting here, and it gets to one of the questions that you raise in the book, well, why did the Tea Party happen in Boston and not, say, New York, for example? It has to do with the fact that apparently the people in Boston were not quite so rigorous in observing this boycott of British tea.
Yeah, between 1767 and 1773, some legal tea does get into Boston and into the New England market. And so the New Yorkers and the Philadelphians, who were trying their best to stick to this boycott and get all their tea through smuggling only, they were starting to get a little bit annoyed with the Bostonians from the fact that some of this legal tea was leaking into the New England market.
Mm. And so how in what way did the revolutionaries in Philadelphia and in New York, how did they try to put pressure on their compatriots in Boston to be with the program?
Well, there was very little way for them to pressure the Bostonians because they live quite far away, but they did send some angry letters and write some angry newspaper pieces to try and shame the Bostonians into recognizing that the colonists weren't going to be successful at pressuring Parliament unless they all stuck together.
Hmm. Well, then the next big thing, and maybe this really was the precipitating event, and also it gets to the famous saying about all politics being local. If you ask about, well, what really was this about and why did it happen there? This comes in 1773. So they pass a new law, and it doesn't really increase the tax. That's still there. So that's still something for people to be unhappy about. But it made some other changes. And so now what was going to happen was that the tea would be shipped from Britain to a handful of handpicked American agents, and they would receive the tea, and then they would get the opportunity. They then would have a monopoly on selling it.
Yeah, more or less. They were going to be able to sell tea now at a dramatically cheaper price. So actually the price of tea was now going to fall for Americans. But the reason why this really angers the Sons of Liberty is that now they have to worry that tea is going to be so cheap that it's going to seduce Americans into drinking legal tea and therefore paying the tax that had been levied in 1767 and then giving up the principle of no taxation without representation.
And also people were mad there in Boston because the revenues from the sale of the tea, that tax was going to pay the salaries of some of the government officials there?
Yeah, absolutely. This was very controversial. The Massachusetts liked to be able to make sure that its governor was accountable to them by having the governor's salary paid by the assembly. But if the governor's salary is going to be paid from the British Treasury through these taxes instead, then the governor isn't as accountable to them. And so they're really worried about this. And it looks like a kind of very sinister conspiracy that the very man, the governor, who would be enforcing these customs duties is the one who profits from the collection of those duties. Mm.
And for the people that ended up being selected to be the exclusive purveyors of British tea, was that how did that happen? Who did these people turn out to be?
Well, that's what makes it even more insidious, is that two of them are Governor Hutchinson's sons, and then Richard Clark and Sons. Richard Clark was a very good friend of Hutchinson, and they were related by marriage, and the others were kind of connected to those two firms as well through either marriage or family or close business partnerships. And so it looks like this little cabal of friends and family of the governor, which makes it all the more creepy and scary for the Sons of Liberty.
Yeah. So there, here it offers this explanation that among the things that people were mad about, I mean, they were mad about the tax, but they've been mad about the tax for a while. That seemed like they were unhappy about the fact that a few people would get a monopoly on selling the tea. And then those people, the people who would benefit from that and the people who would benefit from the revenues, were all people that were politically connected. They were within the ruling circle in Boston.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're one of the people who has been shut out, one of the merchants who has been shut out from this trade as a result, if you're not one of those handpicked merchants, whether you're a legal tea merchant or an illegal tea merchant, this is going to be something that causes a lot of resentment.
Mm. Now, as a background here, another thing that really makes this interesting is that it has some, we talk a lot today about globalization. Well, there certainly was global trade at that time, and this has connections with what was going on globally, particularly what was going on at the time with the British East India Company.
Yes, the British East India Company is the company that has this monopoly on tea sales in the British Empire. And the Americans were aware of some of the things that the East India Company was doing. And one of the things that it's doing is it's becoming increasingly a territorial power in the area around Bengal in India. And so the Americans are looking at this curiously and saying, here's a private company who can send soldiers out and act basically as an arm of the empire. If they can do that in India, what might they be able to do if they get a foothold in America?
So, and maybe there's one other party we need to bring in here that would have feelings about this, and that is the people who are involved in smuggling, because now suddenly the British tea is a lot cheaper, and they have now this, for those people who are willing to do business with the British, now they're being underpriced.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, the whole reason for being a smuggler is that you can get the goods to people at a cheaper price, and so if that's undercut, you're out of luck.
Just very quickly, for anybody who's just tuned in, we're talking with Benjamin Karp. He's Associate Professor of History at Tufts University. He teaches the history of early America. And we are talking about the Boston Tea Party. This is something that is a particular interest of his. He's written a lot about it. In fact, he has written a book that's titled Defiance of the Patriots, The Boston Tea Party and the Making of America. That's published by the Yale University Press. It looks at the event itself, and then it also looks at how people have thought about it in the years since the Boston Tea Party. And as he said at the beginning, the fact that for a long time afterwards, people with various kinds of political causes have identified with the Tea Party and those people who dumped the tea into the Boston Harbor in 1773. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. So here now, even before the revolutionaries there in Boston, the Sons of Liberty in Boston, had been facing pressure from their colleagues elsewhere, particularly in Philadelphia and New York, to be with the program and to boycott British tea. So now, as a result of these changes, British tea gets cheaper, so that's more difficult for them. So they no doubt are facing increasing pressure from outside. But they're also facing pressure in their own town from a number of people who, for all these reasons you've explained, are really unhappy about this situation. So when these ships come sailing into Boston Harbor with this tea, this is a real problem for the Sons of Liberty in Boston.
Yeah, and the Sons of Liberty really spring into action. They mobilize on every level. There are official town meetings. Eventually, the official town meetings become even broader meetings of the body of the people that welcome people from the surrounding towns around Boston. You've got the New England Caucus and possibly even the Freemasons, who are all meeting and very concerned about the tea and trying to do everything they can to stop the tea from landing in Boston Harbor so as not to undermine these agreements that they have with New York City and Philadelphia.
So the boats are sitting there. They're in the harbor, and the tea's on the boat. And what they really wanted was for the ships just to turn around and leave. They did not want it to be offloaded. They just wanted to get out of there. And it seemed like they tried everything they could to persuade all of the people who might be in a position to make that happen to do something so that the tea would just leave and the problem would sail away.
Yeah. They pressure the handpicked merchants to say, just give up your commission and don't receive the tea, and then it'll have to go back. They pressure the ship owners, and the ship owners are like truckers. They're basically neutral parties in this, but illegally they couldn't just turn their ships around if they had dutiable goods aboard. So they're very reluctant to do this. And they pressure customs officials and the governor, who are the ones who could maybe give these ships a buy and just let them go back to London without trying to enforce the customs laws. And so they're trying to pressure everyone they can, but the people that they're encountering are being very, very stubborn.
Mm-hmm. So the ships, they sit there for almost 3 weeks. And the reason that's important is that there's a guess. It's when the ships arrive, a clock starts to run, in effect. And it says that at a certain point, that the customs officials, if the tea is not, that someone doesn't take delivery, if it's not unloaded and accounted for, at a certain point, the customs officers could just seize it, and that would be, and that would sell it. The tax would get paid, which was what they really wanted not to happen. So the reason it happens, the Tea Party happens, and it happens when it does, is that it's right at that point. And so they had to, if they were going to prevent the tea from being offloaded, they had to do something, and they had to do it right then.
That's right. They have to beat the clock. And they were basically worried that the Navy and the customs officials at midnight, when it becomes 12:01 a.m. on December 17th, that was going to be the moment that the customs officials would swoop down, seize the tea, and begin to make it available. And so the 16th is basically the last day that they're going to have a chance to do something about this.
Yeah. So we can I have a caller here. I'll get right to you, and we can talk some more about what happened and how it happened and so forth. But is there some sense of how it is that the discussion moved through, we might do this or we might do this, and then it got to the point where people felt there simply was no alternative to the action that they ultimately took?
Yes, there's extensive discussion. There's attempt to pressure these handpicked merchants. There's an attempt to pressure the ship owners. They, they send people to the customs officials to say, will you allow the ships to go? They even send one of the ship owners, Francis Roach. They make him walk 7 miles to Milton, to the governor's country house, to ask him, beg him, can you turn my ship around before it gets seized? And the governor says no. And it's the moment when Francis Roach comes miserably trudging back to Boston and reports that the governor had said no, and that's when the Mohawks show up, these disguised men show up and start and the Tea Party begins.
So it must have been that there were some people there who had this kind of fallback plan. They were already thinking, if it comes to it, we're going to have to do something, and it's going to have to be something pretty dramatic. So that there were some people that were in a sense ready. They had thought about it. They had their costumes ready to go. They were pretty much organized because they felt that it was going to come to that point.
Yeah, it seems pretty clear that there had been some advanced planning for the fallback plan of having to mm-hmm. destroy the tea.
All right, let's talk with the caller. We have someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'm calling in and wanted to refer to a point made earlier on, a question, I think, by David, which was, why were the Tea Party people organized in New England and there wasn't such resistance in the middle or the middle colonies? And I think, as a New Englander, it's because there's a real cultural difference in the way that these places were governed. you've already referred to the tradition of the strong town meetings and the independent spirit, and the southern colonies were not much more genteel, and they were organized very differently.
I think that
I'd love to have you comment.
Sure. Yes,
I think that's correct in some ways, and it's a great, great question. There was organizing in both the middle colonies and the southern colonies, because some of the ships bearing tea were sent to New York City and Philadelphia and Charleston, South Carolina, at exactly the same moment in 1773. And in New York, they get together and they pressure the consignees, these handpicked merchants, into resigning, so that there's going to be no one to receive the tea. And in Philadelphia, same thing. There's even in the newspaper, they talk about a committee of tarring and feathering that would visit any pilots who would be willing to bring these tea ships into the harbor. So you actually do see this organization. And in some ways, maybe they were emulating the New England town meetings. I don't know. But you do see this organization in both those places. In Charleston, they actually do allow the tea to land, but they insist on locking that tea up in a warehouse where the tea is basically left to rot and it's never sold. But in New York City and Philadelphia, eventually, after the Boston Tea Party happens, but eventually the tea does get to those other harbors and the tea ships turn right around and they never land. So in New York and Philadelphia, they were successful at turning the tea around, which is why there's no dramatic destruction that takes place in those places. In Boston, it was only because the governor was so stubborn that the Tea Party has to happen there.
Mm. And you don't think that that's necessarily because there was any more of this sort of a spirit of rough democracy in New England than there was in Philadelphia and in New York?
No, I mean, I think in this case, if anything, the New Yorkers and the Philadelphians look more radical, and they're the ones who are having to pressure the Bostonians into doing their patriotic duty.
Okay. I don't know. Is the caller still there? Does that get at your question?
No, thank you. I think that's very nice to hear that clarification.
All right. Very good.
And amplification.
Well, question, I appreciate the question. And again, others, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And again, our guest is Benjamin Karp. He is Associate Professor of History at Tufts University. He teaches the history of early America there and has a recent book out that's about the Boston Tea Party that's titled Defiance of the Patriots, and it's published by the Yale University Press. So it comes to this point where the people there in Boston feel that there's nothing, they have no alternative but to go onto the ships, to pull up that tea from the hold, to smash open these big crates of tea. And there's a lot of it, 46 tons of it. And so they dump it into the harbor. How was that accomplished? This actually would have been a really big job. We're talking about a lot of stuff. Certainly by weight, we're talking about a lot of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you needed men with strong backs to accomplish this task, and you needed men with experience on unloading a ship. And we have to remember that, you know, Boston is a seaport town. Most of the men had probably worked aboard merchant ships at one time in their lives, and so probably a lot of the guys who were doing the destroying of the tea were experienced. They also had help from block and tackle, right? That helps to distribute the weight and allow you to lift more than you otherwise would be able to lift. But yeah, they're able to accomplish this task and dump all of that tea into the water in about 2 or 3 hours. So they worked very efficiently.
And this, what we're talking about in at that time and at this time, we're talking about a lot of money and merchandise here.
Yeah, it ended up the East India Company later claimed over 9,600 British pounds sterling, which would be the equivalent of about $1 to $2 million today. To give you an idea, a ton of tea cost about the same as Paul Revere's house in the North End at that time.
Wow.
So picture 46 houses worth of merchandise being just completely destroyed and waterlogged.
And you think that one of the big questions about this event ever after has been, well, who exactly took part in this? How many people? You think, you know, maybe there were maybe about 100 people involved?
Yeah, maybe 100, maybe 150. I only have the names of 100, and and we can't even be positive about those.
So that's one of the really interesting things about this, is that for quite a few years afterwards, for decades afterwards, there was a code of silence observed by people who were involved in this. Anybody who knew anything about it nobody said anything.
Yeah, for almost 50 years, this was as far as I can tell, this was locked up as a complete secret. There was no one in Boston who was willing to talk about having participated in this action.
Now, that's it's you can certainly see right around the time of this why people would do that, because here we're people, if it had been known that they were involved in this, they would have gotten in a whole lot of trouble. But you would think, well, after the revolution broke out, after the Declaration of Independence, after independence, that at that point it would have been okay for people who have said that they were involved. In fact, because this was such an important event, you might think, well, there would be people who would be quite willing to say, yeah, I was there, I was a part of this thing.
Yeah, maybe they'd throw a parade in your honor. But I think there's two main reasons why people weren't willing to come forward. One is that I think they were still worried about the civil liability. Mm-hmm. The East India Company still existed, and maybe there was an idea that even though there might not be a criminal prosecution, that there might be a civil lawsuit on behalf of the East India Company to try and recover some of the property damage that they had suffered. So you didn't want to be the one guy who stands out there and say, oh, yeah, sure, I was responsible, because then you'd be on the hook for 9,600 British pounds sterling worth of money. So you didn't want to be the guy who stepped forward and said that. And then the second reason is that I think early on there was something a little bit disreputable, actually, about the Boston Tea Party. You weren't supposed to go around destroying things, even if it was in the name of patriotism. And on the western frontier up in Maine, all sorts of people liked to dress up in Indian disguise and commit chaotic and unlawful acts. And so it wasn't necessarily the kind of thing that was reputable to confess to.
And that, I think, is an important point you make about the legacy of the Tea Party. That is that ever since, there have been, as we said, there have been a lot of people who wanted to make a connection to it and who said, you know, what we're doing now is like what they were doing then. And so it's been a kind of touchstone for revolutionaries. But at the same time, there have been people who have been very worried about that kind of mob action and have said, you know, maybe we really shouldn't be honoring this event quite so much, because it's a pretty potentially dangerous thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're the kind of person who's willing to put your principles above the law, then the Tea Party looks like the most inspiring event you could possibly imagine. But if you're the kind of person who worries that if we allow people to just act on their principles instead of obeying the law, that the result will be anarchy, then maybe you're not going to necessarily see the Boston Tea Party as something that you should be emulating at all times. Mm.
We have some other callers. We're getting a few more lined up. The first in line is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
This touches on what you're just talking about right now. I'm just kind of curious about what the general overall population's response to what happened with the Tea Party might have been. I know that there was a lot of contention, and I wondered if there was something that said sort of the majority thought this or the majority thought that. And I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thank you.
Well, I think it's a great question, but I think it's difficult, right? There was no public opinion polls being around then. I think the majority of Boston was behind it, and in fact, what they end up doing afterwards is they blame these handpicked merchants and they blame the governor for basically forcing the Bostonians into doing this. They say, well, it wasn't our fault; we had no choice but to destroy the tea. But elsewhere in the colonies, there's some nervousness. People like George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, who's over in London at the time, are nervous about this, and they say, look, this is a rash action. This isn't going to get Parliament on our side. This might have been a step too far. And initially, Benjamin Franklin even urges Boston to pay the East India Company back for the damages. So there are people, people of a more moderate caste or a more conservative caste who really thought that this was maybe not the best thing for the Bostonians to have done. But there are also, you know, radical Sons of Liberty who are like, yes, this was exactly the kind of message that we had to send.
Mm-hmm. Someone here must be listening online because they're in New York. Line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, this is Jim in New York, listening online. I enjoyed your book very much, Dr. Karp. But I've got a question. Could you speak to the notion that the conflict around the tea at that time increased the role of women in American politics?
Yes, absolutely. It's one of the most fun things about the book was discovering this. Women are involved in the protest against tea in all sorts of ways. The most important way was in being part of these boycotts, because men were big tea drinkers, but women, of course, were big tea drinkers as well. They really enjoyed the tea ritual as something that they had control over, right? It was the hostess who supervised over tea very often. They sometimes enjoyed it as a way to get together when men weren't present at all. And so if any boycott of tea was going to succeed, both before the Tea Party and after the Tea Party, when the boycotts really ramp up, as in 1774, if any of these boycotts are going to succeed, you needed women's help. And so all over the newspapers, you see men pleading with women, sometimes in kind of misogynistic ways, but sometimes in very encouraging ways, pleading with women to support this boycott and do their patriotic duty as well. And so women, I think, respond to this and say, hey, you know, we have political importance in this case as well. And then on a smaller scale, on the day of the Tea Party itself, women helped the men prepare their disguises. They helped the men clean off their disguises afterwards. There are all sorts of great stories about women participating in this. And women also helped connect some of these Tea Party participants to each other, because some of them were related to each other by marriage. So women, and then later on, women actually are very often the ones who tell the story of the Tea Party to their grandchildren. And so in some cases, we wouldn't have even known about who some of the Tea Party participants were if it hadn't been for women passing along their stories of what their husbands had done or what their fathers or grandfathers had done.
And later, when you also make the point, we talked about how various different people with different causes later on really wanted to connect to the Tea Party. One of the groups that really identified with the Tea Party were those women who were fighting to secure the vote.
Yeah, especially in the centennial anniversary of the Tea Party in 1873, there's a meeting in Boston where women suffragists play a tremendous role, and they talk about taxation without representation. You know, that if women don't have the vote, then they too can be taxed without being represented in the United States government. And so they use the Tea Party and the message of the Tea Party for that purpose of gaining civil rights.
Mm-hmm. Another caller in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Oh, good morning. Yes. I'm going to be sure to pick up your book because I just love colonial history. But I wanted to ask if it isn't the case down to this day that we would rather not, as Americans, examine the frankly squalid, brutal, illegal traffic that goes along with really a big social changes, whether it's the treatment of Indians, whether it's the Boston Tea Party, which was, by some accounts, at times, and some of the I'm thinking too of the Stamp Act riots, where they completely destroyed the houses of royal agents or people who were perceived to be, when people were tarred and feathered, and when there was a certain amount of payback. To this day, we don't want that side of the story emerging in textbooks.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, and I'll say I don't shy away from that in the book. There are all sorts of ugly sides to the Boston Tea Party, and I do discuss those things. I mean, I think there's a reason for that. I mean, when you get into the United States and you start talking about what are we going to teach children about in the textbook, there's a certain amount of myth-making that's going to take place, and there's a certain amount of flattening of the ugly sides of the story that's going to take place. And so, I mean, that's, you know, one of the reasons why you have to keep reading history further so that you can get a little bit more of the real story and not just a kind of comforting childhood tale. But you're right. I mean, the Bostonians could be quite violent when they wanted to get their way. And I mean, I also talk about what the Indian disguises said about treatment of Native Americans during that time. I even have a chapter on slavery and how slavery has some connections to the issues surrounding the Boston Tea Party, because you can't drink tea without sugar, and most sugar at that time in America and in Great Britain was being grown by enslaved peoples.
Well, I certainly will look forward to your book, and not just because of its vile aspects.
I try and create a balanced portrait, but I think you'll enjoy it, and I appreciate your question.
We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of focus. Our guest is Benjamin Karp. He's an associate professor of history at Tufts University, where he teaches the history of early America. And we're talking about the Boston Tea Party, a particular event that has a very particular interest in. And he's authored a book about it. The title is Defiance of the Patriots, The Boston Tea Party and the Making of America. And it is published by the Yale University Press. Let's come back to the Indian angle of this. I'd like to have you talk some more about, you know, of all of the things that they could have done, could have adopted as disguises. Why is it that they dressed as Indians?
Yeah, why an Indian disguise? Mm-hmm. It seems so strange. I mean, first of all, they can't have imagined that their disguises would actually work, because even though it was dark and even though they've completely covered their faces in soot or lamp black or paint, it's a town of 16,000 people. That's about the size of a large college campus, and and only half of them are men, you know, and only an even smaller percentage would have been men of the right age who wouldn't have been too old or too small. It's a very young population in Boston actually at the time, and so I think you would imagine that if these people were familiar in town, even if you couldn't see their faces, you knew how they walked, you knew how they carried themselves. You probably knew who the people were under those disguises. But I think what the disguises are really a warning to bystanders and spectators that you better not tell who we are. And trying to get the community behind the idea of preserving these people's identities and keeping their identities secret. But you're right. I mean, given all that, it still could be any disguise. Why a Native American disguise? The Boston Tea Party was neither the first time nor the last time that white Americans put on Native American disguises. And I think the reason why you do it, it's complicated, but I think one of the reasons why you do it is it's a way of saying we're not British. We're something new. We're Americans. I mean, in British political cartoons at the time, all of America was generally represented by a Native American, in the same way that today an elephant represents the Republican Party and a donkey represents the Democratic Party. In the 18th century, if you saw a Native American in a cartoon, that represented the Americans. And so the Americans were kind of reappropriating this identity and saying, fine, if you're going to see us as savages, we're going to act like savages. Of course, you know, this is a very racist way maybe to think about actual Native Americans, but this is what they were doing, is they were saying, well, we don't think of ourselves as actually being like Native Americans, but we're willing to take on that identity to distinguish ourselves from the British, because they're feeling themselves moving further and further apart from the British Empire. That process is in the middle of going on.
And certainly at that time, you're not going to meet any Indians walking down the street in Boston.
No, in fact, there was a law on the books ever since the late 17th century that Indians weren't allowed to set foot in Boston. I don't think that law was actually enforced that late in the 18th century, but you're right. I mean, they dressed up as Mohawks, supposedly, and actual Mohawks lived hundreds of miles away in what's now upstate New York.
As you explained, for something like 50 years after this event, people maintained silence. Nobody said that they had participated. Nobody said, I know who participated. Nobody really wanted, for good reasons you explained, nobody really wanted to talk about it. But things really started to change, particularly, I guess, about 1830 or in the 1830s, when people did start talking about it and people got really excited about telling the story.
Yeah, I mean, it even becomes safe enough that people talk about it in court as part of their petitions, their veterans' petitions to the U.S. government. So people are even swearing under oath that they had been in a part of the Boston Tea Party. But you really don't start to see that. The first instance I've seen of that is in 1820. But it's slow during the 1820s, and then it really picks up. I mean, I think people who had genuinely been at the Tea Party start to feel encouraged that once they've heard one person talk about it, that they say, okay, it's no longer a code of silence anymore. I feel more comfortable stepping forward and talking about this in the newspaper. In other cases, it's not that people were coming forward. It was that they were passing away because they were old men, and it comes out in the obituary. that's then reprinted in the newspaper. That's the only way somebody like me can hear about it sometimes, because I see it in the documents that I'm finding in the archives. And then also, I think some people were encouraged to say, hey, this is like saying you were at Woodstock, right? I mean, no one was taking attendance at the Boston Tea Party. I might as well step forward and say that I was an American hero. And so I think there are some fraudsters who take the opportunity to come forward and say, yeah, I was there too.
Yeah. And it's really amazing the wide range of people who have claimed connection to this. We talked earlier about women who were people who were involved in the women's suffrage movement, but everybody from people on who were civil rights activists on one side, all the way over to people like the Klan on the other side, said they were identifying with this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's pro-temperance forces in the 1850s and then anti-prohibition forces in the 1920s. You have, yes, civil rights people, and then you also have white supremacists. You have anti-abolitionists in the 1830s and then abolitionists in the 1850s. So even on both sides of the same issue, you'll have people embracing the Boston Tea Party and saying that it speaks to them.
Were there people, though, who you mentioned that there were people who were a little worried about this and celebrating this kind of violent action and destruction of property? Were there actually people who came right out and said, look, this was an important event in the history of America, and yes, it had something to do with starting the revolution, but we ought to be very careful about celebrating this?
Yeah. One of the people who I think that's really interesting is the writer Nathaniel Hawthorne. Kind of says, you know, this was a romantic event, but let's keep it a mystery who these guys actually were. And I think, you know, Hawthorne was a somewhat conservative guy, and so I think, you know, he was really reluctant to hear these stories come out. But ironically, his own wife's grandfather was one of the Tea Party participants, a guy named Joseph Pierce Palmer. So that's one of the things that makes it very curious, where he probably knew who one of the Tea Party participants were, but he's still coming out in the newspapers and saying, you know, let them go to their graves and preserving this secret to their graves. That idea appealed to him a lot more than talking openly about who had been participating in this.
And I want to again have you come back to the subject of slavery. And one of the questions that you raise, or the sort of discussions that you have here, has to do with the fact that the revolutionaries at the time, as they talked a lot about slavery, they talked about feeling that they were being enslaved. And yet, at the same time, there was the real institution of slavery going on. Were there any people who said, hey, now, wait a minute, yes, we have some issues here as far as the British are concerned, but, you know, there's another really big issue here that we have?
Yes, I mean, there are people who kind of hear this language of slavery and say, well, what about the actual slaves? But I think it's a very small minority overall. I mean, James Otis mentions it. There are various Quaker families in New England who mention it, including the Roaches, you know, one of the families that owned one of the tea ships. There's at least one Tea Party participant, a guy named James Swan, who is originally from Scotland, who had published a pamphlet a year before the Boston Tea Party, criticizing the man wolves who were involved in the slave trade. And there are a variety of other ministers and politicians who are against the slave trade or are speaking out against slavery itself. But ironically, once the Tea Party happens, and then also all of a sudden Massachusetts really needs alliances with the southern colonies, all of a sudden Massachusetts doesn't want to talk very – people from Massachusetts or politicians from Massachusetts don't want to talk very loudly about their anti-slavery views, because they know they're really going to turn off the South Carolinians who rely on the institution of slavery for their economy. So in a way, the Tea Party takes everyone's eyes off of the issue in a really tragic way.
Yeah, and there is also this interesting connection with sugar, just because, as you say, the sugar was produced by slave labor, and, well, what would tea be without sugar?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I asked the question, you know, if people were willing to boycott tea in order to protest the acts of Parliament, why wasn't there anyone who stood up and said, well, why don't we boycott sugar to protest slavery? But I can't find any evidence of a kind of widespread mobilization behind that idea until the 1790s in Great Britain, when there are female anti-slavery activists who say, well, we're going to boycott sugar and not take any more sugar with our tea until the slave trade is stopped. But you don't see that kind of movement happening in the United States until much, much later.
We have just about 5 minutes left in this part of the show. Again, our guest is Benjamin Karp. He's Associate Professor of History at Tufts University. He is the author of the book Defiance of the Patriots. It's about the Boston Tea Party. And if someone has a question they want to call real quick, I'm sure we can get him in. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, back, this was now some months back before the book was published, you wrote a piece that was published in the Washington Post about the contemporary Tea Party. They must have thought that it would be a natural for somebody like you, who is an authority on the historical Tea Party, to maybe go to a meeting of the contemporary Tea Party and see what you found, and perhaps also ask people, as you did, who were involved in the Tea Party now, well, what do you know about the Tea Party, and what was it about, and how is it that you feel connected with that event?
Yeah, that was a really great experience. And I mean, I wasn't trying to be a kind of ask gotcha questions, you know, and say, how is the original Tea Party like this Tea Party, and have them say no taxation without representation. And then I could say, well, you know, we are actually represented in Congress these days. But they had an interesting answer to that question, which is, you know, they felt, no, you know, we're not necessarily that well represented in Congress. Congressmen are more willing to listen to lobbyists than they are to ordinary citizens. And I thought that was an interesting sort of argument, that they really feel this connection with the original Tea Party in that way. I've talked to other people in the contemporary Tea Party movement. I don't necessarily agree with all of their priorities, but I do think that there are some interesting connections between the original event and the current Tea Party movement. I mean, the obvious difference is that going around and proclaiming membership in a Tea Party is something that the people of 1773 just couldn't do. And in fact, the name Boston Tea Party doesn't even I can't find any evidence of it before the 1820s. Originally, it was just called the Destruction of the Tea in Boston Harbor.
Mm-hmm. It seems to be remarkable that this event would have this kind of resonance now, ever after all these years after, and this the tea bag. Of course, people at that time of the Tea Party, they didn't have tea bags, but the tea bag, you could wave a tea bag, or you could cover yourself in tea bags, and that would have a symbolic significance that would be widely recognized. So that this thing still has that kind of potency. So if you just say Tea Party, people have a pretty good sense of what that means, and it can still work as a rallying cry.
Yeah, it's instant recognition, and it's interesting how deeply that's permeated in our culture, that we have this kind of instant symbol that we can all look to. Now, I mean, I think, you know, sometimes people have an understanding of the Boston Tea Party that doesn't go beyond maybe what they learned in school or from reading Johnny Tremaine or something. So I think that you can read a little bit more deeply into the story and learn a bit more about it. And I think people are often surprised and really gratified to learn a little bit more about the event.
Yeah. And I'm sure you would not say, one couldn't say that the revolution would not have happened had the Tea Party not have happened, but you also have to make this connection between the Tea Party, the way the British reacted, and that we get then the revolution becomes kind of like the proverbial snowball rolling down the hill. It seemed to get to the point where there was a certain inevitability about it.
I mean, things are relatively peaceful in Boston between the Boston Massacre in 1770 and then the Tea Party itself in 1773. So, I mean, it was even maybe pointing towards a little bit more rapprochement or reconciliation between Great Britain and the colonies. But then once the Boston Tea Party happened, the members of Parliament are so outraged by this, and the punishments that they mete out to Boston and Massachusetts are so severe that now all of a sudden you're at a point where negotiation becomes a lot less likely, and things do then become violent very quickly. Within a year, there are already people willing to take up arms and march through the countryside to defend Boston.
This way, we talked earlier about the fact that the value of the tea, this was a significant amount of money either then or now. And I think that it was the case that at the time that maybe the British East India Company was having some financial difficulties. Was this a problem? Did this create problems for the company?
The East India Company was suffering financially, but part of the reason why the Parliament had passed the Tea Act is it's part of a reform program that's trying to consolidate government control a little bit more over the East India Company and get them on a better footing financially. The East India Company is eventually going to basically die off and be replaced by the India Office that the British government uses as part of its government branch for running India in the 19th century. The East India Company was suffering a lot financially, and the Tea Act was really supposed to be part of a government reform program to make the East India Company work better.
At the time, outside of the colonies and Britain, did other governments take notice of this?
I haven't seen a tremendous amount of evidence by that. I mean, yes. I mean, you know, there were some who were like, wow, this is in the middle of the war. There were French or Germans or even people in India who were saying, wow, this huge 8-year war is going on now, and it all happened because of a cargo of tea. And they're sort of almost bemused by this. And there are some cartoons that printed in France and Germany that mention the Tea Party in one way or another. So they're very curious about this. I mean, as we know, the French are later going to be inspired by the American Revolution. I don't know whether they were specifically fascinated by the Tea Party itself. Mm.
And just we talked earlier about the kind of pressure that the revolutionaries in Boston were facing from their compatriots in places like Philadelphia and New York. When this happened in Philadelphia and New York, did they turn to each other and say, well, how about those guys in Boston? Look at that.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, the news arrives in Philadelphia about the Boston Tea Party, which had taken place on December 16th. The news arrives on Christmas Eve in Philadelphia, and one of the radical printers creates a special edition called A Christmas Box, as in it was a Christmas present to Philadelphia to hear this great news from Boston.
Well, with that, we will finish up. There is even more. It's a great story in the book. So if you'd like to learn more about the Boston Tea Party, the book is Defiance of the Patriots, The Boston Tea Party and the Making of America. It's published by the Yale University Press by our guest, Benjamin Karp. He is Associate Professor of History at Tufts University. And Professor Karp, thank you very much.
Thank you for a great conversation.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website. Anytime that you're ready to listen, just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
As you make your year-end giving decisions, please consider a gift to WILL. Listener support is the heart and soul of this station, and your gift will help pay for the programs you rely on next year. You can make a contribution online now at willpledge.org or mail a check to Friends of WILL, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Thank you.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at commodity prices where at the mid-session, there is plenty of strength in the commodity market. Following up on what we saw yesterday, makes it 2 days in a row. More strength today in the corn than there was yesterday, a little less strength in the soybeans, but nonetheless, plenty of green on the screen. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, March wheat now at 856 and a quarter, up 12 and a half. The May at 865, up 12 and a half. And the July is 869 and three quarters, up 12 and a quarter. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade is trading now at 796 and three quarters, up 16 and a half. The May, 822, up 14 and three quarters. July, 833, up 14 and a quarter. March corn, 622 and a quarter, up 7. May, 630 and a quarter, up 7 and a quarter. July, 633 and three quarters, up 7 and a quarter. September, 585, up 5 and a half. December, 555 and a half, up 2 and a quarter. January soybeans are trading at 1379 and a quarter, up 6 and a quarter. March, 1390 and a half, up 6. May, 1397, up 6. July, $14 and a half, up 7 and three quarters. August, 731, up 6 and a quarter. September, 1331, up 7 and a half. January soybean meal, 368.20, up 180. March, 372, up 170. January soybean oil, 57.22, up 7. March, 57.79, up 4. December live cattle, 105.95, up 105.